welcome to Aryan Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 3rd of February 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at RadioAlbion.com. Well, it's the first day of the week for a new sovereign Britain, and I'm very pleased to say that we do have with us today Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good afternoon to you, sir. How are you doing? Are you very pleased that we have now finally left the European Union and are a sovereign nation once again?
I was just about to say, actually, that I am very pleased, yes, and before you asked. And so the answer, obviously, is in the affirmative. I think that this is going to go down in history as a very momentous occasion. I think that despite the sometimes reluctance on the part of the Conservatives, and even as far as Boris Johnson is concerned, even though there is a degree of reluctance on his part to automatically go full speed into a no deal kind of Brexit and one that asserts our complete independence and national sovereignty, the fact of the matter is that I think circumstances are dragging him along a path toward in that direction, because all that's happened since last Friday is that we've had statements being made by the European Union where they appear to be backtracking on things that they promised him during the course of the negotiations, which has tended to anger him, and also situations where they have been trying to encourage the Scots to press even harder for an independence referendum so that they can leave their partnership with us and go and become slaves to Europe, which seems to be a ridiculous state of affairs for a country that's supposed to be run by a nationalist political party. But there we are. We live in a time when there are these kind of ludicrous contradictions where we have political parties in the extreme parts of the British Isles who purport to be nationalists, but who seek to separate themselves from their allies and allied nations amongst the kindred nations of these isles, and to make themselves slaves to Europe, which just seemed to me to be incredibly strange. And I can remember some years back, I was attending a wedding in Southern Ireland. And during the course of the wedding, there were a couple of wags who thought that it was very funny to make statements about Irish freedom in a very sort of loud and verbose way, knowing that there was a small minority of English people who were part of the wedding party. And I can remember then just pointing out that it was very strange that they were celebrating the fact that they've left the relatively benign partnership they had with the UK and had fought and shed all that blood over all those many years, only to then meekly roll over and become slaves to the European Union. And that tended to shut them up.
Yeah, it's a similar situation. The European Soviet Union is what it is, basically.
Absolutely.
I was very, very pleased to see the celebrations that went off. There was a light show, there was fireworks, there were thousands of people, there were some very beautiful women dressed in Union Jack dresses. I mean, women do look really good dressed up in our national flag. I was impressed with that, and there was lots of songs that were sung. And the next day, it does seem, as you're saying there, as if the EU has backtracked on a lot of the things that it said, and Boris Johnson and his administration seem to be pushing for quite a hard Brexit. No alignment. They're saying there's going to be no rule taking. We're now in charge. We're now responsible. We're not going to be able to blame anything on the EU. It's all on our shoulders. And all of this is very, very positive. And I've heard them saying that they're going to do something about immigration. They're now going to be controlling immigration. They keep talking about this points-based system that they're going to be coming up with. And it's all very, very positive at the moment. And as you say, the Scots are pushing to have this Scottish referendum, which is really ridiculous, because the vote was for the whole of the United Kingdom. It wasn't for the different nations. It was for the whole of the United Kingdom. I mean, it's rather like Southampton saying, well, we didn't vote to leave the EU, so now we want to leave the UK. It's irrelevant whether Southampton voted for that or not, because it was all the votes together from the United Kingdom that mattered. So to be going on about it is really just, you know, it's just sore losers. And you would think that the EU would know better than to do that, because they condemn Catalonia for wanting to do that. And they've upheld Spain's very, very heavy response to that of locking people up and cracking heads, basically. And the EU seems to support that. So they really just seem to want to be sponsoring subversion of the United Kingdom, I think.
Yes.
It's going to be interesting to see what happens.
One little point I would just like to make is that I have written a couple of articles about the founding father of the European Union on the Western Swing website, the Count Kuhnov Kalergi. Many people will be aware of the fact that he wrote a book which was called Practitioner Idealismus, in which he set out his plans for the forthcoming European Union, because at the point when he wrote the book, the European Union didn't exist. And many people will know that I had been working on a translation that I was doing myself. My German isn't particularly good, but I was attempting a translation, and I got approximately about a quarter of the way through the book. But I was contacted recently by a lady who has actually completed an English translation of the book. Her name is Dimitra Ekmektsis, and she has now published a book. It's published by Omnia Veritas, but it's available through Amazon on the internet, and I think it cost me £18. And I've read the translation now, and it would be truthful to say a translation that might need just a little bit more polishing for the people who are aficionados of language and grammar. But from the point of view of it actually conveying the full meaning of the text, it is a very good translation. And so I would heartily recommend that to anybody who would like to have a read of Practitioner Idealismus. In fact, the book is published with the English title of Practical Idealism. But it's Practical Idealism, the Kalergi Plan to Destroy European Peoples. And so, as I say, I would recommend anybody who wants to spend £18 just buying that book, because it's very educational.
Yeah, the copy that was available, the translation that was available online before then, it was quite hard, very hard to actually read. I mean, I had a look at it, and it looked like there was a lot of interesting stuff in there that was showing that he was supportive of Freemasonry, he was supportive of having a Jewish oligarchy ruling over a mongrelized new race of Europeans mixed with Africans, sort of like the modern day Egyptian. But trying to actually read the individual sentences were very, very difficult. So I'm very pleased that there's a translation of that is out now. I mean, that does seem to be what the plan for the EU was all along. They still have their Kuhnov Kalergi Prize that they give out. I think it was called the Charlemagne Award at one time as well. They changed the name of it. But I mean, a lot of people will say, well, that's conspiracy theory. So now at least this book is out there. People can look at it and show that, no, this isn't a conspiracy theory, that this is the father of the European Union, and this is what his plan was, and it's coming to fruition today with, yes, you know, with the refugee crisis, the immigration crisis, the invasion. Right, I don't know if you want to add anything more to that. I mean, it was just a big celebration. To me, it seemed like it was, you know, it's exactly the same the next day, and for the rest of the year, we are in a transition period where none of the rules have actually changed. We're still paying all the money in. So it won't actually be until January 31st next year that we do actually leave. I mean, this was just sort of leaving on paper. So, you know, it really didn't seem that important to me until I saw all the people celebrating on the television. Maybe I sort of missed out a bit on it. I don't know. It just didn't seem that important to me, because we're going on for another year. Did it seem particularly important to you, Max?
Yes, it did. I think that what's happened here is that, and this is what I was referring to a little bit earlier on when I mentioned that Boris Johnson hasn't always been quite as enthusiastic about Brexit as one might have hoped. And I would have hoped that the government would have put a bit more oomph behind getting Big Ben ready to chime so that it could chime, because it turned out that, you know, there was a campaign to raise the money to pay for the temporary works that would be needed so that Big Ben could chime. And I think most of that money had been raised, and the shortfall was a drop in the ocean. And it appeared to me to almost be a political decision on the part of the government that they couldn't really be bothered to pay that bit extra so that it could actually happen. And what I think we saw on Friday evening was the people of Britain organising their own celebrations. And obviously there were the celebrations in London with the Brexit Party and Nigel Farage, etc. But all around the country, there were people that were holding their own mini celebrations. And I know that there was a campaign amongst nationalists for people to buy fireworks and to buy rockets and to set them all off at 11 o'clock precisely. And I'm sure, I haven't heard back from anybody yet that went to one of those parties, but I'm pretty sure that they went on in a large number of locations all over the UK. So I think that what we've had is basically a people's Brexit celebration, and a Brexit celebration that was a little bit muted, certainly from the point of view of what people saw on their TV screens, just solely because the government didn't put a lot of oomph behind it, didn't put a lot of money behind it. And the media certainly weren't going to promote the occasion as anything to celebrate, and so that's why if you only watched it on television, it might have appeared somewhat muted. But I'm sure those people that went, and I've certainly heard back from some people who did go to London for the celebrations in London, that it was a very exhilarating occasion for them.
Well, it's certainly great to see a big upswelling of patriotism like that. And it was mentioned on the television, oh, I've never seen so many white people all in one place. You know, the same as Jon Snow said a while back at a demonstration that he was actually pulled up for saying. So it certainly seems as if it's implicit nationalism there from everybody involved, implicit ethnic nationalism, I would suggest, since 99% of the people that were celebrating were white. And of course, that's a good thing. We need to harness that energy there and concentrate it on more nationalist causes now that we have succeeded with Brexit. And I've also got a couple of other news stories that I want to get into before we get into our greatest Britons this week, which will be Boadicea, which I'm very much looking forward to. But just at the start of the weekend, Katie Hopkins was banned from Twitter. And this is, you know, this is really quite scandalous. I mean, she had a million supporters on Twitter. She had a million followers, and that is a hell of a lot of people that were reading her Twitter. Now, I used to enjoy reading her Twitter. I know people complain that she's a rabid Zionist, but everything else that she said, you know, I could go along with. Okay, she supports Israel, but she was very good at criticizing the grooming gangs, very good at criticizing immigration into Britain, talking about the replacement of white people, very, very good at exposing what was going on in South Africa and the farm murders. And she wasn't banned because any of her tweets had been flagged and investigated. She had had tweets before that had been flagged and they'd been investigated by Twitter, and she'd been told that she was okay. So the reason for this ban is because the co-presenter of Channel 4's Countdown went and spoke to Twitter demanding that they remove her account, which I just find really shocking that this, and incidentally, this presenter is Jewish, and she was working alongside some Muslims in some kind of anti-hate group that they had. And they made a quote afterwards and they said, "We are pleased that preliminary action appears to have been taken by Twitter against the identity-based hate actor Katie Hopkins following productive discussions with Twitter's UK office," said CCDH's campaign against hate chief executive Imran Ahmed. And then they said, "There is a long road ahead before social media is made safe for dialogue, information exchange and the formation and maintenance of relationships. And I thought, how could they say that with a straight face? Are they trying to be sarcastic there? Is that an ironic sentence? I mean, they're talking about safer dialogue. They've just removed half of the dialogue. How can you have a dialogue when you're just talking to yourself? The whole point of Twitter is that you can have a dialogue between two opposing points of view. And what they've done here is they've said, no, we're going to remove that point of view. We're going to remove the point of view that a million people want to hear about, that a million people tuned into the Twitter feed each day to read. We're just going to ban them from actually seeing the views that they want to see. And this information exchange, how can you exchange information if somebody is just going to go up there and get that information removed? I mean, they're not saying that what she was saying was wrong at all. They're just saying, oh, she's an identity-based hate actor. And apparently it was to do with a tweet towards Stormzy where she was pointing out that in actual fact it's white people that are sent to the back of the queue now. It's white people that are told that they can't apply for jobs. And apparently this was considered to be racist. And that was the tweet that she was actually banned from Twitter for. And then just as this happened, 2 days later, there was another news story about a fake award ceremony that had been set up by a South African leftist group. And they had pretended to be a free speech organization. And they got in touch with Katie and said, we want to give you an award for free speech. Now, I suspect that Katie knew that something was amiss, but they basically got her to go to Prague. And they set up what they call actors pretending to be racists to listen to her speech afterwards and record it and then show everybody what a racist she was. And they had a rude word flashed up behind her. And I just thought, this, what an absolutely disgusting thing to do, to pretend to somebody that you're going to be doing something nice for them, to give them a prize and an award. And in actual fact, you're just getting them there so that you can laugh at her. I mean, what a disgusting thing to do to a woman. And at the same time that this news story came out, they've removed her from Twitter. So she can't answer back. She can't say, well, I knew all along that this was fake and that you were pranking me. They've just removed her ability to actually speak to the public, and they just want their narrative to come across. Look at what a nasty hater this woman is, and we've done this, played this nasty trick on her. And I think the people actually playing the nasty trick are going to come off, they will actually come off worse from that. I think that's a really nasty thing to do, to say, yeah, pretend you're going to do something nice and then stab somebody in the back. Again, it just shows you how these people, they have no concept of self-analysis, no concept of actually what they look like in what they're doing. I mean, this disgusting behavior, censoring somebody and then pretending to do something nice for them. I don't know if you heard about this at all. Max, got any views on Katie Hopkins being banned from Twitter?
Well, I think this is something that we've grown to expect over the years, a situation in which there is always this call for diversity and the multiculturalists and the wokerati, as they've been named, they're always campaigning for diversity, and they want diversity in everything apart from diversity of opinions. It's that they, when it comes to opinions, they want just their opinion and nobody else's opinion. And it makes me laugh when you were saying about how they wanted to make Twitter a safe place, you know, which is just this use of this word safe. It's thrown into all sorts of statements made by people who are politically correct. And it's what it's intended to convey is the impression that there is violence going to be aimed at the people that they are supposedly protecting, when in reality there is no violence aimed at the people they're protecting. They're just using this this mythical threat of violence as a means to justify the fact that they are trying to build a totalitarian society. They can't turn around and say, we're busily building a totalitarian society where we squeeze out everybody's viewpoint apart from our own, because that doesn't sound very nice. That doesn't sound very sexy. But if they turn around and they say that they're trying to make all these media safe for people to express their views and to socialize with each other, well, then that tends to sound a whole lot better. But it is really just a load of cant. And what it seems here is that when Katie Hopkins complains about discrimination against white people, that is interpreted as hate. But when non-white people complain about discrimination aimed at them from white people, that's diversity. That's them trying to spread goodness and diversity. Whereas when white people complain about being discriminated against, it's hate. And so there is obviously a double standard here, and it's a double standard that stinks. It's been stinking for years. It still stinks, and it will continue to stink in the future. And
just to say there as well, Max, I mean, it's a million people that they've riled up the wrong way there as well. A million followers. So in actual fact, I mean, by doing that, they will have, you know, just confirmed to those million people that all they are about is censorship, and that everything Katie was saying about the censorship of whites and the censorship of whites who speak up about discrimination against them in grooming gangs, everything she said was true, because she's been banned from Twitter despite having a following of a million people. I mean, that's just incredible to me. A million people, they can just totally disregard the views of those million people, whilst at the same time saying that they're trying to, they want to make it safe for the formation and maintenance of relationships. Well, they've just cut the relationship between Katie and a million people. How can they say that with a straight face? Sorry, continue, Max.
No, we're just in a situation. This analogy has been made in the past, and I think it's quite a truthful analogy, that in days of old, when people who campaigned for the freedom and self-determination of our people, who campaigned for the right of us to have ethnic and racial survival, there weren't very many of us, and it was easier for the people who are the establishment, people who are the agents of political correctness, it was easy for them to clamp down on what we were doing harshly, and not very many people would know what they were doing. Not many people would be aware of the fact that there was this anti-democratic movement taking place on their part. But what's happened is that, you know, largely as a result of the internet and the fact that our views are able to be spread more easily as a result of the existence of the internet, what's happening now is a situation where when these clampdowns take place, that large numbers of people now get to hear about it. Large numbers of people become affected by it, because those people have, as you've just said, have signed up to follow a particular individual, in this case, Katie Hopkins, on Twitter. And now they've been denied the ability to follow her. And so they will all be aware of the fact that their civil rights, that their right to freedom of speech, that their right to listen to what Katie Hopkins has to say, those rights have been curtailed and been trampled on. And we are in a period which is very similar to the period just shortly before the collapse of the Soviet Union and the collapse of the Eastern Bloc countries, when the vast majority of people started to become aware of just how corrupt the old Soviet Union was, and that the old Eastern Bloc dictatorships were, a period is going to unfold ahead of us now, in which increasingly people are going to become more and more aware of just how petty and vindictive and just how utterly corrupt so many levels of our government are, so many levels of our public services and public bodies, just how corrupt they are. And eventually a point is going to be reached, just as it was reached within the Soviet Union, where eventually the majority of people just turn their backs on authority and demand something better, something new to take its place. And I can't wait for that to happen. And I think it's ironic that another story that's in the news this weekend is the story of Alastair Stewart, who many people will know him from the fact that he's been a very popular news broadcaster on television, and he's been a news broadcaster on television for in excess of 40 years, and he's a man of similar age to myself, and he was a student at the same time as myself, and we can all feel we can all feel a certain amount of sympathy for him, the fact that he has been just for using a word that could be construed to have a racial connotation. The equality lobby have decided that, yes, And they're going to put the worst possible spin on what he said. They're going to impose the worst and most severe possible interpretation of what he said. And he's been confronted by I think it's ITV that he worked for, and he's been forced into resigning. And whilst we can feel a certain amount of sympathy for him, that sympathy shouldn't be too great in my view, in his particular case, because of the fact that during the time that he and I were both students, he was very active in the National Union of Students, campaigning against the right of people to have freedom of speech when those people disagreed or expressed views that he disagreed with. And he was one of the people who was campaigning for the National Front at the time, for them to be deplatformed so that people who were representatives of the National Front couldn't go to universities and speak to students. And so it is ironic that he has now been he has now lost his career as a result of the very people that he helped to create, the very forces within our society that he helped to create when he was a younger man. And it's interesting that I think it was in the on the Daily Mail's website today, there was an article by Trevor Phillips, who used to be the head of the Equalities and Human Rights Commission, and who knows all about race relations and this sort of thing, where he is quite sadly explaining that Alistair Stewart isn't racist at all, and that it's very sad that things have reached a point now where even somebody as mild-mannered and well-intentioned as Alistair Stewart can actually lose their career as a result of just saying one word out of place. The support of Trevor Phillips only goes to reinforce just, you know, what a radical person Alistair Stewart was in his youth. And if you read the article written by Trevor Phillips, he talks about how they went to conferences where there were other groups that were there that were communists, that were radical feminist groups, etc., and all of the people who nowadays make up the hordes of political correctness. And so whilst it is sad that a man who has made a 40-year-long career as a newscaster, and who has been a very popular newscaster at that, I won't attempt to take that away from him, it is to some extent sort of wryly ironic that he has been brought down by his own creation, effectively.
He helped to create the situation where somebody like himself could be deplatformed, asked to resign simply for using a word that people nowadays complain about. He was actually just quoting from Shakespeare, and the Shakespeare, the line itself contained the words angry ape. And he had used this line before in conversation with somebody who was white. He certainly wasn't meaning to call the person that he was having the dialogue with, who happened to be black, he certainly wasn't meaning to be calling him an angry ape in a racial sense. He was saying that he was an ape in the sense that William Shakespeare used it. I mean, that should have been obvious. He's quoting William Shakespeare, so he means it in the sense that William Shakespeare meant it when he wrote that piece. And again, it just shows the craziness of these outrage mobs that demand that people be deplatformed for saying these things. And Trevor Phillips, actually, he may have been the head of the Equalities and Human Rights Commission, but since he's left there, I mean, the political correctness has doubled, and he has actually spoken out for white people. I remember recently he spoke out about the fact that this school had refused to take the money that was sent to them to help poor white students. And he said how wrong this was, and poor white students are right at the bottom of the pecking order. They're doing the worst out of all those students in Britain, and they really need a leg up. And it's totally wrong that Stormzy can give out millions of pounds to help black students into university, but this elderly chap that wanted to give out money for a scholarship for poor white students to attend university, that he couldn't do that. And he actually spoke up for whites. So, you know, maybe Trevor Phillips is, you know, seeing common sense now. I would hope so. But just this banning of people because you don't like their views under the excuse of, oh, it was racism, oh, it was hate speech. And it's totally one-sided, because it's only the same things that the non-whites say. But if it's a white person that says it, then that's it. You're going to get banned. And again, this using this word here that Shakespeare used, that maybe it's changed over the years. I don't think we should have any banned words. It just seems to me that they create these words, they change them every few years, and it's just done so that they can catch people out, so that they can then use it to catch people out that aren't quite up to date with the latest trend in terminology that you should be using for non-whites, basically. I mean, I can recall words changing just in my lifetime.
Yeah. I also think it was quite amusing. An amusing aspect of this was the fact that Alistair Stewart, I believe, has stood as a Lib Dem candidate in the past. And this chap who he used the phrase, the offending phrase in connection with just recently, turns out to have been a researcher for the Liberal Democrats as well. And so one aspect of all of this now is that the sort of people who champion this kind of thing are turning in on each other. And I think that it's one of the features of the way in which our society and with regard to free speech has evolved over recent decades, is that people of our political persuasion who have needed to make cogent arguments in the interests of our own people, and often make cogent arguments that are in opposition to the spread and influx into this country of people from other parts of the world. We have had to learn how to say things in a way in which they our words are effective, but at the same time using words that keep us safe from the encroaching censorship of the law. Whereas people like Alistair Stewart, who have adopted a more cavalier approach to promoting multiculturalism and multiracialism, and who have, according to Trevor Phillips, Alistair Stewart liked to lace his words with rhetorical flourishes. And it seems that one of the things that he hasn't been trained to do is to choose his words carefully, in the same way that we choose our words carefully, and that's been his downfall. Yeah, so it's a matter of hubris to some extent, causing pride to go before a fall, as far as Alistair Stewart is concerned.
Well, poetic justice as well. If he was part of the people that were, you know, calling for the National Front to be deplatformed and for nationalists to be deplatformed and to not allow them to have free speech, I mean, he helped to create the environment where he himself was asked to step down for simply quoting Shakespeare. Well, as I said, we're going to get into another one of our greatest Britons here, and the greatest Briton this week is going to be Boadicea. Last week I talked about the two aviators, the two female aviators, when you weren't here, Max, and I mentioned during that you know that I see women with lots of children as being heroines, but you know that's not entirely fair of me to say that, because we have had warrior queens in the past. We also had Ethelfled as well in Mercia, but the greatest one of our warrior queens was Boadicea. And rather than going to Wikipedia to get some notes on this and then quoting them and discussing them, I've actually got a very good book on history that was written in 1857. The author was called R.W. Morgan, and the book was called The British Cymry or Britons of Cambria, Outlines of Their History and Institutions from the Earliest to the Present Times, primary source edition. And it's available at archive.org. It's a fantastic book. It's a very, very patriotic book, and it uses Welsh sources, Roman sources, Greek sources, and it really does tell the story of Boadicea well. And I've got a couple of bits that we can contrast it with the way that Wikipedia tells it as well, because R.W. Morgan comes to different conclusions from similar evidence to the conclusions that Wikipedia come to. And also it contains the full speech of Boadicea, which is a fantastic, rousing nationalist speech. So I'm really, really looking forward to getting into this one. I believe you are familiar with Norfolk, Max, and this is the sort of area where Boadicea was. I mean, is she still noted there? Is she still spoken about? Are there statues of her? Is it sort of one of the things that Norfolk is most proud of, having Queen Boadicea there at all?
I haven't seen any statues of Boadicea personally, but there is quite a celebration in various parts of Norfolk of the Iceni, who were the tribe that that she was the queen of. And so there are a number of places, a number of centres, a number of buildings that are named after the Iceni. And there is a preserved Iron Age village of the Iceni that you can go and visit in Norfolk as well.
Oh, that's really good. That's really good. Because we did have these different tribes at the time. This was before the Saxons came. It was actually in AD 60. So I'll begin with the quotes here. In AD 60, the Boadicean War in the east of Britain was added to that which raged in the west under Arviragus. And that's because it was basically a war with the Romans. And that war actually went on for 40 years. I mean, this was a long war. The Britons were a fierce, formidable foe, basically. There had been two Roman invasions before them, both by Caesar, and in both of them, the Romans lost. So this was really the third time that Rome had attempted to subdue Britain. And this war actually went on for 40 years. But this was a big highlight of it, was the Boadicean Revolt. The cause of it was as follows. Senecia, the usurer, had without due notice given, demanded immediate repayment of his loan to the Iceni, with interest charged at an exorbitant rate. On the Icenic Senate demurring to the rate of interest and requesting time to realise the necessary funds to discharge the principal, orders at the instigation of Senecia were sent by Nero to the Roman prefect to take possession of all the public temples, castles and palaces belonging to the state. And this is interesting because the British people, they didn't get involved in usury. We didn't engage in usury. And this was quite a new thing. And this Senecia, he was quite desperate to make this money out of the Iceni, basically. And because he wasn't paid back quickly enough, he got Nero to tell the Romans to just take possession of everything. The order was rigorously executed. A Roman force was marched upon Castor near Norwich and the garrisons placed in the inferior fortresses. A few months subsequent to these peremptory measures, and while the Iceni were still smarting under the sense of degradation, Prasutagus the king had died, leaving by his will Nero as co-heir with his two daughters to his accumulation of treasures. And it says there about the Iceni smarting under the sense of degradation. That's because the Iceni had made a peace treaty with Rome. They had agreed to pay the tribute. And in exchange for the tribute, they were supposed to be given control of their lands, given sovereignty, basically. But they were looked upon as traitors by the other tribes in Britain because they had done this. On the pretext that the whole of this royal hoard came under the denomination of public property, Caius Decius proceeded to take possession of it. Resistance being made, the legionaries stormed the palace, perpetrating the most brutal outrages on the persons of Queen Boadicea and her two daughters before carrying off the treasures to the castle. Not content with the commission of these atrocities, Decius issued an edict confiscating, in direct violation of the Claudian Treaty, the estates of many of the Icenic nobility. At the same time as the orders had been dispatched to Decius, Suetonius Paulus, who is stationed at St. Albans, received instructions to extirpate Druidism at all hazards with the sword, and with this view to invade Mona in Anglesey, its chief seat in Cambria. And that was basically the Welsh University. It was the centre of Druidism. It was the central university that they had that was in Anglesey. So at the same time that this was happening, the taking over of the Iceni property, the Romans were heading off to Anglesey to slaughter all the Druids. And I'll just stop there, Max, for your comments on that.
Well, yes, I think this sets the scene very well for us, really. I believe as far as Seneca is concerned, he forced the loan upon the Iceni, and the loan was supposed to be 40 million sesterces. And having forced the loan on them, he would then be able to charge a rate of interest. And this was one of the ways in which usury was used as a weapon against people, by forcing a loan upon them that they were then not able to repay without there being penalties for repayment early, and then to apply a rate of interest that would ensure that the debt would grow, and that the person who owed the debt would never be able to pay it back.
Yes, it was deliberately done. I mean, it was a deliberate setup. The Iceni didn't need the money anyway. They had their own holdings. They had their own land, but they had settled into paying this tribute, and they were basically they'd upset these other tribes, and they were pretty much forced into accepting this loan in the first place, and then they couldn't pay it back. Well, the attack on the Druids began, and the spirit of unbending patriotism, which has in all ages and against all invaders so nobly distinguished the Bardic Order of Britain, was an unpardonable crime in the eyes of an empire whose insatiable lust for territorial aggrandizement calumniated where it could not conquer, and only spared where it could safely despise. The instructions were executed with the ruthless thoroughness characteristic of the Roman service. By a succession of forced marches, Suetonius reached the Straits of the Minae. Here on either side extended the cemeteries of the ancient religion. Here repose between the soaring ramparts of Snowdon and the blue waves of an unexplored and boundless sea, on the furthest verge of the old world, chiefs whose ashes for 1500 years had never been desecrated by the tramp above them of a foreign foe, archdruids, the depositaries of the unwritten wisdom of the East, and kings whose Cymric names had carried terror to southern and far distant lands. And I'll just stop there. I mean, that gives us an idea of the pedigree of Britain. I mean, for 1500 years, the Druids had been going. There was 1500 years of history that most British people today aren't aware of. They think that before the Romans came, you know, we were like savages or barbarians. But we had roads, we had cities, we had 40 different universities in Britain, according to Caesar, and all the nobility from Gaul would come over here to be educated. And as I said, we defeated Rome the first couple of times when Caesar tried to take over. I mean, Britain was a really formidable foe, and this was a real centre of it. This was the religious centre. This was where all the important people were buried. This is where our ancestors were buried, and Rome had just decided to destroy the place, basically. Through these sanctuaries of so many and such ancient memories, the regulated march of the mailed legions of Rome now resounded. But behind them, a nation was rising in arms. Whilst Druidic priests and priestess were being butchered on their own altars by the Roman sword, and the waters of the Minae were illuminated night and day by the glare of the conflagration of the sacred groves, tens of thousands of Roman citizens were expiating with their lives the nefarious massacre. No sooner had the first intimation of the real nature of the expedition of Paulinus been made known than the war became a religious crusade. So it wasn't just the defiling of Boadicea; it was the desecration of the Druidic sanctuary that really got the backs up of the British here. Do you know? Have you heard about this attack on Anglesey? This attack on Mona? Before, Max?
No, actually, I wasn't aware of it until today. But, you know, the words that you've just been reading out to us there are very, very descriptive and set the scene really, really well. And we can see why the Iceni and the other tribes, the ancient Britons, why they were so so angered by what was taking place and why they felt it was necessary for them to revolt against against Roman domination.
And it was you know, it was pretty barbaric as well what they actually ended up doing to the Romans. But the Iceni and the Carinidae had so entirely forfeited the name of Britons that their oppression alone would have been regarded in the light of a just retribution. But the massacre of the Minae merged this feeling into one of universal indignation and horror. And that's because, as I said, the Iceni had capitulated to Rome and also this other tribe called the Carinidae. So the rest of Britain, if it had just been this attack on Boadicea, maybe they wouldn't have been, you know, they wouldn't have actually got any support. But because of this destruction of the Druidic temples, the Britons were furious. Offers of support poured in from all quarters, and Boadicea soon found herself at the head of 120,000 men. The Roman accounts impress us vividly with the deep gloom in which the Roman forces were plunged by a series of portents, all the more interesting as they are recorded in full faith by the pen of the philosophic historian Tacitus, who in the preceding page reproaches the Druidic religion as a sanguinary superstition. At Colchester, the statue of victory, like that of Dagon at Joppa, fell backwards and was broken into fragments. A pythoness as agitated as Cassandra on the eve of the fall of Troy, with the irrepressible spirit of divination, caused the streets to re-echo with her involuntary cry, "Death is at hand." In the Roman Senate House, the British war cry, uttered by invisible tongues, terrified and dispersed the councillors. The theatres resounded with the groans and wailings of a field of battle. In the waters of the Thames appeared the mirage of a Roman colony, subverted and in ruins. The channel between Dover and Calais ran at high tide with blood, and on the tide receding, the sands revealed in long lines the impressions of files of bodies, as if laid out for burial. And remember, Tacitus, just before writing this, had been reproaching the Druids for superstitions. And then he writes this about everything that the Romans saw. The Minae massacre had, in fact, no less terrified the conscience of its perpetrators than it had roused beyond control the religious fury of the British population. The deity, states Dion Cassius, predicted by these and other omens the magnitude of the impending disasters. The war was marked indeed by all the atrocities on both sides which have ever been the characteristic of religious crusades. And all that was new to me. I didn't realise that, you know, they had actually had all these omens.
This is the sort of thing that somebody ought to make a...
Yeah.
There ought to be a full feature film made of this story, shouldn't there, don't you think?
Definitely, definitely. Boadicea's prayer we've got next. The British army assembled at Carlisle, Leicester, under Venusius, and was harangued in person by Boudicca. The description of the person of the outraged queen by Dion is exceedingly interesting. Boadicea mounted the general's tribunal. Her stature was of the largest, her appearance terrible, her aspect calm and collected, her voice deep and stern. Her hair fell as low as the hips in long golden tresses, collected around her forehead by a golden coronet. She wore a tartan dress, fitting closely to the bosom, but below the waist opening in loose folds as a gown. Over it was a chlamys, or military cloak. This was her usual attire, but on this occasion she also carried a spear. And, you know, that's how I imagine her seeing. So that description there must have been sort of held to, because when you imagine seeing, you know, in your mind's eye of what Boadicea looks like, I imagine her looking like that. And in the statue that they did of her, they actually did, on her chariot, they had scythes coming out from the wheels. And I noted that in the Wikipedia report of this, they said, oh, that was an anachronism, that there were scythes on the wheels like the ones in Persia. But in actual fact, Caesar writes about that, about the Britons being in chariots with scythes on the wheels, and the scythes on the wheels actually go back to Troy. It's actually more evidence to the early tales of the Britons actually coming from Troy, because these chariots with these scythes on them, Rome didn't have them, and they had stopped having them in Persia for quite some time. But where Britain was outside of the Roman Empire, we still had them. And it also tells us, because we had these chariots, that we also had a system of roads, proper roads, not muddy tracks. I mean, you can't can't have a horse and chariot on a muddy track. You have to have proper stones there, a proper surface to actually travel along. Have you heard of this description before, Max? What do you think of this? Wearing a tartan dress and the golden coronet on her forehead.
Yeah, I think she sounds very dramatic and formidable. I would think that she would be very charismatic as a queen. You asked me actually earlier, and it didn't occur to me at the time, but there is a statue of Boadicea in Great Yarmouth. I mentioned in an earlier episode of this program, Heir in Britannia, that when we spoke about Lord Nelson, I mentioned that there was a monument to Lord Nelson in Great Yarmouth. And that monument, although it is a monument to Lord Nelson, at the very top of the tower, instead of it being a statue of Nelson, is a statue of Boadicea.
And also the name Boadicea, it's as you say, it means victory. And Victoria, Queen Victoria herself was named after Boadicea. And you were mentioned in the Victorian times is really when this story got told a lot, and they made a lot of it. But the actual recordings of it go right back to shortly after the time that it happened. So we know that these descriptions are accurate. One of them, I think, was written at the time, and the other one was written about 50 years after, something like that. So these are accurate descriptions. Her prayer to Andraste, the British goddess of victory, will give a fair idea of the spirit and tenor of her address. I thank thee, I worship thee, I appeal to thee, a woman to a woman, O Andraste. I rule not like Nitocris over beasts of burden, as are the effeminate nations of the East, nor like Semiramis over mere tradesmen and traffickers like the Egyptians, nor like the man-woman, Nero, over slaves and eunuchs. Such is the precious literature these Romans would introduce among us. But I rule over Britons, little skilled indeed in craft and policy, but born and trained to the game of war. Men who in the cause of liberty stake down their own lives, the lives of their wives and children, their lands and property. Queen of such a race, I implore thine aid for freedom, for victory over enemies infamous for the wantonness of the wrongs they inflict, for their perversion of justice, for their contempt of religion, for their insatiable greed, and a people also that revel in unmanly pleasures, that cannot live without luxurious dishes, or sleep except on beds of down, whose affections are more to be dreaded and abhorred than their wars. Never let a foreigner bear rule over me or these my countrymen. Never let slavery reign in this isle. Its proper home is Rome. Be thou alone forever, O goddess of manhood and of victory, sovereign and queen in Britain. And that's a great speech there. And there is loads in that we could get into. I didn't want to actually stop at each bit because I wanted to get the whole feel of it across. But going back to what she was saying, what she was saying there, the effeminate nations of the East, Nitocris, who rules over the beasts of burden, and Semiramis, who rules over tradesmen and traffickers like the Egyptians, and then the man-woman Nero, and then talking about the Romans introducing literature, which encourages this stuff. Now, how relevant to that is today? This, you know, this effeminate encouragement of men to be like women, and the corrupting literature that we have. And it all, and also this, you know, introducing foreigners and foreign rule over the British people. I mean, I was really struck with how similar that is to what's going on today. What do you make of that, Max?
Yeah, I think that analogy fits very well. I think perhaps it's it may have been since the beginning of time a tactic on the part of monolithic empires who want to a far-flung part of their empire to introduce all forms of perversion and
effeminacy
in order to make the population of that province soft, that's right, and easy to dominate.
Yes, this idea of accusing your enemies of being effeminate, this was the worst insult that could be laid at the feet of anyone at the time. It's also in Josephus and his histories of Judea. That's a great insult in there. And this Nero, I mean, he was absolutely crazy. And, you know, he could hardly inspire his army to actually fight for him. There was one instance where he actually bottled out of attacking Britain and got his men to collect seashells from the beach while putting seaweed over his head. And he made this speech about, we'll just take these shells as the beauties of nature rather than wasting lives by going over and fighting against the barbaric Britons or words, you know, similar to that. Nero was quite well known as this crazy guy. I think he actually had a Jewish mistress as well, who was the one that it was encouraging him to persecute the Christians, because at this time you just had we'd had the crucifixion, and the apostles were sort of making their way out from Judea and Rome, and there was persecution of them at the time, because it was shortly after this that Christianity really took off in Britain. Maybe that had something to do with all the Druid sanctuaries being destroyed. I don't know, because I have read that the Druids were quite friendly to the apostles and to the early Christians. But this insult of them being effeminate, I mean, if you look at today, men are just being encouraged all the time to be effeminate. And the ways that we're being subverted is through the literature and through the mainstream media. And the Romans were doing exactly the same. And you think what they had actually done to Boadicea, or to her daughters, this horrific rape. I think they actually whipped Boadicea herself. Yeah. I mean, this is a huge insult to the British people to do this to their queen. And because of all this, you know, the way that we've been encouraged with this effeminacy, you think, you know, we've had 1,400 white girls that were raped by the grooming gangs, you know, more than that. And there really hasn't been any pushback against it, because we've all succumbed to this effeminate literature, what it calls it here. And you think this was just, you know, the defiling of two women, basically, and one of them was whipped. And there was this huge, huge revolt. Well, the revolt begins. Colchester was carried on the first assault by the British army. The temple garrisoned by the veterans held out for 2 days and then shared the same fate. Petilius Cerealis, the Roman lieutenant, was defeated with the loss of the whole of the 9th Legion at Cogia Hall. That's Cocky Collis. Cerealis himself, with a few horsemen, escaped into camp. The municipal town of Verulam was in the same manner stormed, gutted, and burned. And I've got the first quote here from Wikipedia, which goes into more detail of the sacking of Colchester. Tacitus mentions long-standing reasons for the Trinovantes to hate Rome. The Trinovantes were another tribe that joined the Iceni. It was against the veterans that their hatred was most intense. For these new settlers in the colony of Camalodunum drove people out of their houses, ejected them from their farms, called them captives and slaves. And again, that reminded me of people being turfed out of their council houses so they can put Syrian refugees in there, and 60% of London now being non-white. And you had a similar thing happening here with the Romans that were replacing the Trinovantes, who were actually in Colchester, and originally they were in London, because Trinovante means New Troy, and London was originally New Troy. So they must have moved up to Colchester from London. The rebels' first target was Camalodunum, modern Colchester, the former Trinovantian capital, and at that time, a Roman colony. The Roman veterans who had been settled there had mistreated the locals, and a temple to the former Emperor Claudius had been erected there at local expense, making the city a focus for resentment. The Roman inhabitants sought reinforcements from the procurator, Catus Decianus, but he sent only 200 auxiliary troops. Boudicca's army fell on the poorly defended city and destroyed it, besieging the last defenders in the temple for 2 days before it fell. A bronze statue to the Emperor Nero, which probably stood in front of the temple, was decapitated and its head taken as a trophy by Boudicca's army. Archaeologists have shown that the city was methodically demolished. The future governor Quintus Petilius Cerealis, then commanding the 9th Legion, attempted to relieve the city, but suffered an overwhelming defeat. The infantry with him were all killed. Only the commander and some of his cavalry escaped. The victorious enemy met Petius Cerealis, commander of the 9th Legion, as he was coming to the rescue, routed his troops, and destroyed all his infantry. Cerealis escaped with some cavalry into the camp and was saved by its fortifications. The location of this battle is unknown, but has been claimed by some modern localities. After this defeat, Catius Decianus fled to Gaul. Do you know anything about that one, Max? The sacking of Colchester? Is that talked about there?
I don't know Colchester very well, I don't have any sort of specific information about the sacking of Colchester, apart from just a comment that for the Roman legions to be defeated in the way that they were here would have taken a tremendous amount of military tactical prowess and strategic prowess. You know, the Roman legions were renowned for their ability to take on opposing forces of greater numbers and to prevail over those greater forces. The troops were all very well equipped with armor, were all very well equipped with those large rectangular shields, and they could form a phalanx that would then make them virtually impermeable to attacks by using arrows or spears from their enemies. And for the British tribal armies, which is effectively what they were, for them to be able to take on the Romans and beat them would have been a very considerable feat that they would have undoubtedly celebrated very widely and very enthusiastically afterwards.
They were a formidable foe. We're getting back to the destruction of London now, and this is R.W. Morgan, his account again. London, during the protracted absence of Arviragus in the west, that was the king that was making war on the Romans in the west, had once again failed in its allegiance and received a Roman garrison under the name of a colony within its walls. Its commerce at this period was so extensive that the Roman citizens alone resident in it were estimated at 50,000. If we calculate these at so high as a sixth part of its whole population, we have a strong, although undesigned, confirmation of the extreme antiquity assigned by the British historians to the foundation and splendour of the British capital. Against it, the British army, now swelled to 230,000 men, directed its vengeance. Such of the inhabitants as possessed the means fled at its approach. The rest, including the Roman citizens and foreign merchants, took refuge with the garrison in the ramparts extending from the Temple of Diana to the White Mount. The ramparts were escalated, the city fired in four different quarters, public buildings and private residences reduced alike to ashes. No quarter or ransom, states Tacitus, was given or taken on either side in this war. It is difficult to conjecture how many lives were sacrificed in this act of national justice. Tacitus implies that before the engagement with Paulinus, more than 70,000 Romans had fallen, either in garrison or in the field. It is worthy of remark that the only time London has been rifled and destroyed has been not by a foreign enemy, but by a British queen and a British army, visiting it with condign punishment for its collusion with a foreign invader. The lesson appears never to have been forgotten, for its citizens have ever since been the first to repel the open attacks or insidious influences of foreign powers, leaving this terrible example of a metropolis smouldering in ashes, quenched with the blood of its inhabitants behind. Boadicea swept westwards with her forces. Tacitus records but two engagements, Dion many, between her and the Roman general. Her epithet in the British chronicles, Verdig or Victoria, implies that in not a few of these, successes attended her arms. So they totally destroyed London.
Yeah.
Completely. Completely. I've got a Wikipedia account of this as well. When news of the rebellion reached Suetonius, he hurried along Watling Street through hostile territory to Londinium. Londinium was a relatively new settlement founded after the conquest of AD 43, but it had grown to be a thriving commercial centre with a population of traders and probably Roman officials. Suetonius considered giving battle there, but considering his lack of numbers and chastened by Petilius's defeat, decided to sacrifice the city to save the province. And this is a quote from Tacitus. Alarmed by this disaster and by the fury of the province which he had goaded into war by his rapacity, the procurator Catus crossed over into Gaul, Suetonius, however, with wonderful resolution, marched amidst a hostile population to Londinium, which, though undistinguished by the name of a colony, was much frequented by a number of merchants and trading vessels. Uncertain whether he should choose it as a seat of war, as he looked around on his scanty force of soldiers and remembered with what a serious warning the rashness of Petilius had been punished, he resolved to save the province at the cost of a single town. Nor did the tears and weeping of the people, as they implored his aid, deter him from giving the signal of departure and receiving into his army all who would go with him. Those who were chained to the spot by the weakness of their sex, or the infirmity of age, or the attractions of the place, were cut off by the enemy. And then back to Wikipedia's summary. Londinium was abandoned to the rebels, who burnt it down, torturing and killing anyone who had not evacuated with Suetonius. Archaeology shows a thick red layer of burnt debris covering coins and pottery dating before AD 60 within the bounds of Roman Londinium, while Roman-era skulls found in the Walbrook in 2013 may have been victims of the rebels. Verulamium, or St. Albans, was next to be destroyed. In the three settlements destroyed, between 70 and 80,000 people are said to have been killed. Tacitus says that the Britons had no interest in taking or selling prisoners, only in slaughter by gibbet, fire, or cross. Dio's account gives more detail, that the noblest women were impaled on spikes and had their breasts cut off and sewn to their mouths, to the accompaniment of sacrifices, banquets, and wanton behaviour in sacred places, particularly the groves of Andrastae. I mean, that sounds pretty savage, but then you think of what the Romans had done to the Britons' holy places and to their queen. And the other bit I wanted to point out about that was the way that Wikipedia says that London was founded after the conquest of AD 43, but had grown to be a thriving commercial centre. That's contradicted by what R.W. Morgan is saying because of the number of people. Because of the number of people, it shows that that London had been there for centuries. But the narrative today is to pretend that it was the Romans that did it all. Do you see what I mean there, where he's saying about them, you know, it was founded in AD 43, the population of traders, because to whoever was writing that, it's impossible for the Britons to actually have a population of traders of their own and already have a capital city. And then finally, I've got R.W. Morgan's report of the final battle. Tacitus fixes the last battle on the edge of Epping Forest, as do the Greek historian and the British traditions, on the Guadalian Road near Newmarket in Flintshire. The various names on this latter site express so correctly the incidents of the battle that we may almost imagine Dion Cassius examined the ground before writing his description. Here are Cop Paulinius, the Hill of Arrows, the Hill of Carnage, the Hollow of Woe, the Knoll of the Melee, the Hollow of Execution, the Field of the Tribunal, and the Hollow of No Quarter. So they're all names that are still there on the Ordnance Survey maps, and there are a lot of places in Wales that still have names related to these battles. So it's more evidence to say that this all happened, basically. Half a mile distant is the memorial stone, termed the Stone of Lamentation, and on the road to Carruis was formerly, but now removed to Downing, the stone of the grave of Budig, Victoria's tomb. Turning to the pages of Dion, we find the conflict to have been just what these names suggest and perpetuate. A deadly melee of heavy armed legionaries, auxiliaries, archers, cavalry and charioteers mingled together and swaying to and fro in the heady currents of a desperate fight over the whole extent of the ground. But the fortune of the day towards sunset inclined towards the Romans. The Britons were driven back within their entrenchments, leaving a large number dead on the field or prisoners in the hands of the enemy. The rest retired in good order and prepared shortly after to renew the conflict. In the interim, however, Victoria died, according to Tacitus, by poison, according to Dion, in the course of nature. She was buried with profuse magnificence. I mean, that's a magnificent tale, I think, the it history is. Of the Britons. You know, we got that flowing in our blood. That archetype, and particularly the women, you know, our women have that archetype within them to turn into a hellion like that and inspire the army to go out and fight against the foreign invaders. It's a lot of the stuff that was written back then around 1860, it's so patriotic. I mean, all the stuff that I've read from that time has that sort of patriotic flavour to it. And the Brits were so proud of having the British Empire and proud of their achievements. And this was all taught in history lessons, you know, the history of Britain, because it does go back that far. We used to have a book called The Brute or The Chronicles of England that goes right the way back to Brutus, of the Prince of Troy that first colonized Britain. And that was actually the second best-selling book after the Bible.
It's often very informative if you get the opportunity to have a look through an old secondhand bookshop that's got books in it that were written more than say 100 years ago. And to compare, as you say, the writing style of people in those days with the writing style of history books that have been written more recently, and it becomes crystal clear when you do that that there has been a marked shift in the mental approach of the historians of today compared with the historians of the past, where the historians of the past were trying to put together a cogent story of our nation and our people going back into the past, so that people reading their histories would have a sense of history, would have a sense of tradition, would have a sense that they are connected by blood and by spirit with the people that existed in the generations past, whereas all of that has now gone, and what we have are very insipid histories. And whereas the histories of the past would have focused on the sort of thing we've been looking at here this afternoon, which is the struggle of the Iceni and the British tribes to free themselves of domination by the Romans. Instead of having heroic stories of that sort that are intended to inspire the current generations to go on and to even greater glory, what we have are histories that focus on things like the arrangements within local housing areas for the disposal of sewage, or the way in which farmers might use various substances in the raising of their cattle and things of that sort, things which are kind of like social history, but which contain no inspiration for the people that are reading them. And I think that's a great shame. I'm not saying that there's not a place for social history. There obviously is a place for social history and the way in which towns and things developed, but that form of history really is a very lackluster element of history when compared, and a very a less potent form of history than the histories of yesteryear, where they try to thrill us and inspire us with our nation's story.
It's a part of the emasculating literature that the Roman Empire brought. You know, the teaching people histories that people aren't going to be interested in. When I was doing history at school, all I can remember of it is being taught about Jethro Tull's seed drill. I was never told anything exciting like this. And when you think about what people are taught about history today, they're taught to feel guilty. They're taught of the bad things the British Empire did, how we've all got to feel bad and guilty for slavery. We mustn't forget that we're all taught about the Holocaust as well. We were not taught anything inspiring like this, which is, as you say, Max, it was intended to spur the people reading it on to greater glories. And the word itself, history, it's his story. It was supposed to be the story of the British race. And this is what they were trying to piece together. That's what this Brute, the Chronicle of England, was. That was the History of the Kings of Britain by Geoffrey of Monmouth, trying to tie it all in together with the Roman documents and the stuff that was recorded in Greek, and show that the British had just as much of a pedigree as Rome and Greece and our Druidic religion was a very important one for the whole of the continent, and people just not taught it today. But yeah, that's a very, very inspirational story there. I think she was certainly one of our greatest Britons, and she's up there with Alfred the Great and Captain Cook and the others that we've gone through. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Max. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Aerie in Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.